You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes is the French presidential race wide open. Marine Le Pen won't back a candidate. We get the latest from Paris. We get the runners and riders for this year's Turner Prize. We find out what it's like to enjoy a Burmese mini break. And all aboard, ladies and gentlemen, we visit a town so bereft of love, they're bussing the girls in. All that plus a song or two right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. All that to look forward to in the next 60 minutes, but before all that, let's get the latest world headlines from Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Labour rallies marking May Day have been taking place across the world. In Taiwan, hundreds of protesters held up banners and marched through Taipei to demand better worker rights and an end to job insecurity, low salaries and long working hours. In Hong Kong, over 1,000 people marched to the Hong Kong government headquarters.
I think it showed that the workers in Hong Kong are boiling with anger because there's no working hours regulation in Hong Kong. We have the fifth longest working hours in the world.
The French President Nicolas Sarkozy held a giant and elaborately produced May Day rally in front of the Eiffel Tower. With barely 5 days to go before the final round of voting in presidential elections, as opinion polls put him behind the socialist candidate François Hollande, Sarkozy has been engulfed by a tide of unpopularity over the last few months. And Sarkozy supporter Olivier Guillaumin fears the French may be walking into an Hollande presidency without thinking of what it would really mean.
Because the French may realise what they're going into with François Hollande. And they're very keen on criticising what they have, and they're ready to jump into uncertainty. But nothing is sure until the end.
The French far-right leader Marine Le Pen delivered a further blow to President Sarkozy's re-election hopes by refusing to endorse him and telling her 6 million supporters to make their own choice in Sunday's ballot. Le Pen told a rally in Paris that she personally would spoil her ballot paper in the second round by choosing to vote for neither of the two remaining contenders. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is beginning a high-stakes trip to Beijing, where a blind Chinese human rights lawyer is reportedly holed up in the US embassy in a drama threatening to overshadow top-level meetings between the two governments. The US has refused to comment on the whereabouts of Chen Guangcheng, whom activists say is at the US embassy after a dramatic escape from house arrest. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has met opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi in the latest stage of a 3-day visit to Burma to encourage more democratic reforms. Ms. Suu Kyi, who was elected a month ago, spoke at a press conference after the meeting, saying any aid that comes to Burma should be directed at the people.
Whatever aid comes to Burma, whether development aid or humanitarian aid, should come in such a way that it empowers the people and decreases their dependency on the government. That is the only way in which we can ensure that the democratic process in Burma will go along the right path.
A British parliamentary committee has declared News Corp chief executive Rupert Murdoch unfit to run a major international company, saying he should take responsibility for a culture of illegal phone hacking that has shaken the media empire. Lawmakers said the firm had showed willful blindness about the scale of phone hacking.
In the view of the majority of committee members, Rupert Murdoch is not fit to run an international company like BSkyB.
Finally, the flag was flying at half-mast outside the Norwegian Olympic Committee building today in honour of world champion swimmer Alexander Dale Oen, who has died of a suspected heart attack in Arizona at the age of 26. The 2011 world 100-metre breaststroke champion and one of Norway's best hopes for a medal at this year's London Olympics was attending an altitude training camp. Per Rune Eknes, president of the Norwegian Swimming Federation, paid tribute to him.
I will describe him as one of the kindest men I know. He could talk to the prime minister or president the same way as he could talk to a 3-year-old kid or girl in the kindergarten. So he was the same person anyway.
And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. It's 5 minutes past the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Lagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yokoso.
Tama on Monocle 24.
The Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Today in France, on May the 1st, the tradition is to give your loved one a bunch of Lily of the Valley. Traditionally, today is also La Fête du Travail, a day for workers to take to the streets and protest for their rights. The Fête du Travail can infrequently fall in a presidential election period, and this is the case this year. But this year, in addition to the usual protests, Nicolas Sarkozy has chosen to hold a rally himself in honour of those who embody the spirit of work. Well, is this a brilliant piece of electioneering or a shocking capitalisation on a tradition which dates back officially to 1947 and unofficially even longer? Well, to tell us more and bring us up to date with the latest on the elections in France, I'm joined once again by Christine Ocrant, our lady in Paris. A warm welcome once again, Christine. You're in Paris. The essence of May the 1st is for the unions to have their say. What's the atmosphere been like in Paris today?
Well, there's been lots of traffic, let's put it that way, and also great weather, which hadn't happened for days. Lilies of the Valley are out of price, I tell you. This being said, there were three rallies today. Sarkozy, as you mentioned, had created quite a stir by saying he wanted to talk about the real work ethics, to address people who really work. And that was a very unfortunate wording, because immediately, of course, the unions and the Socialist Party and everybody else, as a matter of fact, said, what does it mean, people who really work? Does it mean that people who do not have work are the culprits? Anyway, so Sarkozy held that rally. It was very well staged. It was just at the Trocadéro, you know, facing the Eiffel Tower with hundreds of French flags. And his speech was a little bit more moderate than what he was talking about a few days ago. But it certainly was about work ethics and, you know, vive le drapeau against all those leftists, all those socialists who prefer the red banner. So that was the tone. Then you had another rally, which was Marine Le Pen, because traditionally the extreme right in France celebrates the birth of Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc, everybody knows, having been, by the way, a victim of the British, but that's another story. Anyway, Marine Le Pen took the opportunity to confirm what had been suspected. She said she would not choose between Hollande and Sarkozy. She would vote blank, and she criticized Sarkozy for trying to lure her own voters constantly. Then you had the third rally, the traditional one, the trade unions, to which quite a lot of socialist political politicians joined, including Martine Aubry, who is the boss of the Socialist Party and who is rumored maybe to become the next prime minister if Hollande wins next Sunday. There were, of course, Ségolène Royal and a few others. Hollande himself was not in Paris. He was in Nevers to celebrate a former socialist prime minister who committed suicide a few years ago. So it was a very political Labour Day. And again, you know, everybody is sort of tensing up, waiting for tomorrow evening TV debate.
It sounds incredibly busy in Paris as well. We'll move on to Marine Le Pen and also the televised debate in a moment. But let's go back to the Sarkozy, the sort of unofficial Labour Day rally, because that will obviously go down like a ton, you know, a lead balloon with the unions. But Sarkozy has accused Hollande of hiding behind the unions' flags, hasn't he? About being hiding behind the red flag of the unions.
Well, yes, he has accused the CGT, which is the, you know, historically the communist Union, of having officially, publicly called to vote for Hollande, which is rather not the tradition. You know, trade unions are known to be politically engaged, but they never actually spell it out so openly. This time around, Bernard Thibault, who is the leader of that union, said, you know, we cannot let Sarkozy be re-elected. And that's a paradox, because at the beginning of his term, Sarkozy indeed flattered Thibault and tried to make deals with that particular union. Chérec, François Chérec, who runs the CFDT, which is traditionally a more open trade union, more open to discussing with government. Chérec also was incensed by, you know, at the idea that Sarkozy would compete with the traditional Labour Day rally. So it was really interpreted as an attempt to create yet another divide between workers who are supposed to care about the real values and the real ethics of work, that was Sarkozy's stance, and, you know, the rest of the workers. So it was a rather sort of strange idea, frankly.
You mentioned the Front National rally in the Place de l'Opéra today, and the fact that Marine Le Pen has said that she won't endorse either Hollande or Sarkozy, will cast a blank vote because she says neither Hollande or Sarkozy will actually represent the values of the Front National. Now, she had 18% of the vote of in the first round of the presidential elections. By encouraging her supporters to cast a protest vote, has she effectively thrown the vote open now?
I think she's really aiming at the parliamentary elections, which are to be held early June. She has a double target. Target one is not only to oust Sarkozy, but to explode the traditional Conservative Party, which indeed is already tearing itself up, because one of Sarkozy's government members today, the defense minister, said, well, you know, after all, Marine Le Pen, we can talk to her after all. And that, of course, created immediately an outcry from other Conservative Party members. So she is really, you know, putting the dagger where it hurts. Her second goal is to get into the National Assembly and get as large as possible a number of MPs in the next National Assembly. That's really what she's aiming at.
Nonetheless, despite the fact that she's sticking daggers left, right and centre, this hasn't deterred Monsieur Sarkozy. He's continued to court far-right voters on Tuesday. Apparently in a radio interview, he's saying again that France has too many immigrants.
Yes, of course, he's been hammering at extreme right themes even before the first round, but of course even more so since Sunday, April 22nd, in order to try and gain back, lure back some of these 6.4 million people who voted for Le Pen. He's been Europe bashing. He's been talking about the need for borders, the need for protection. He's been, of course, bashing globalization, all the themes that Marine Le Pen used. Strangely enough, I was just looking at a poll conducted by a pro-European think tank, and they conducted a poll asking their sample of people who, in your view of the two candidates, is the best to argue for French interests in Brussels. And strangely enough, Sarkozy comes first. Now, that doesn't mean anything in the sense that it doesn't represent his credibility on all sorts of issues. But it does show that to those people who are worried about or indeed concerned by European issues and the crisis and all of that, they still believe Sarkozy knows how to lead. It doesn't mean necessarily they want him to lead again, but it's a very paradoxical element, which I think we should take into account.
Now let's turn to tomorrow night's Hollande and Sarkozy head-to-head debate on television. I'm reading an incredibly interesting article in the in today's Le Monde, which is describing just how precise the conditions are that have been laid out by each candidate, saying that there has to be a negotiated charter and there are two separate directors that are basically allowed to work on the debate. It is going to be quite an event, isn't it?
Yes, of course. Mind you, the tradition goes, these rules are not new. They were forged, you know, from one presidential election to the next. They're pretty similar to what happens in the U.S., although in the U.S., before the real confrontation, you have several candidates. But anyway, to get back to the French way, for instance, you cannot, if you are in the box deciding which image you're going to choose, the technician cannot use cutaways. He cannot show the reaction of the other candidate when Hollande or Sarkozy speaks. It's very, very rigid. The story goes that 5 years ago, when Ségolène Royal was the socialist candidate against Sarkozy, she had asked for the temperature in the studio to be 23 degrees centigrade, which is quite warm, especially when you have to try and convince, you know, people to that you are going to be the next president. And her calculation was that way Sarkozy would become red in the face and sweat.
Well, this has all been changed apparently, because I'm just reading here. This is just reports that it's been asked that no profile shot of Monsieur Sarkozy be shown. Also, Monsieur Hollande has to double check that his glasses don't reflect. But when you're talking about temperatures, apparently an air conditioner has been installed for each candidate, so that each candidate is now going to regulate his own temperature as well as the comfort of his own armchair, plus the fact that the table is going to be longer to separate the candidates. This is simply now vanity and has little to do with politics, isn't it, Christine?
Well, it has to do with, how could I put it? It has to do with the extreme care which both entourage want to give to the exercise. And it has to do with a moment where the whole nation will be watching that debate and where, you know, television is about emotion. And so I guess the idea is to control as much as possible all these ingredients which can alter the image which each candidate wants to project. And so, you know, each camp comes out with more and more rules. And indeed, as Le Monde explains, it's getting worse every time.
Christine, thank you.
It's getting more complex.
Christine, thank you very much indeed for joining us. A pleasure as always. Christine O'Connor will be joining us every day this week on Midori House. In a moment, we'll be back for the latest on the Turner Prize shortlist. Stay with us.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Dance.
You are cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
On the latest edition, a standout live session from Bahamas, a lesson in newspaper design from Mario Garcia, a cocktail or two with the movers and shakers of Berlin's art scene, and Freeze New York.
It's supposedly the largest temporary structure that's ever been built anywhere in the world.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Twenty minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for a bit of music. This is Lasting Love by Blood Diamonds. You're listening to Midori House. That was Lasting Love by Blood Diamonds. The time is 24 minutes past the hour. Now, in previous years, the critics have been underwhelmed, overjoyed and outraged by the Turner Prize, seen as a barometer for Britain's artistic climate. This year's nominations, announced today, have been met in most part with approval. Most notably is the inclusion of the magnificently named Spartacus Chetwynd, whose work is predominantly performance-based. Well, to take us through the runners and riders, I'm pleased to say I'm joined by Louisa Buck. She's a contemporary art correspondent for the Art newspaper. A warm welcome to Midori House, Louisa. So we have the nominees in front of us. Who are they, very briefly?
Well, you've got, as you said, the magnificently named Spartacus Chetwynd. She was called rather more humbly Lally Chetwynd at one point, but she's changed her name. She makes, as you've said, these amazing kind of overwhelmingly carnivalesque, bonkers performances that can be about everything from Jabba the Hutt from Star Wars to Dante's Inferno, with all sorts of props. And it's all a bit wobbly and a bit sticky back plastic, but very exuberant and funny and massive installations at the same time. You then have Luke Fowler, Scottish artist, who makes very complex, multi-layered film projection pieces and for film and video works, often about excavating past figures from the past. The one that I particularly was taken by was one about the Scottish psychiatrist R.D. Lang, but it's more than just a documentary. It's about archive footage, contemporary interviews, again, very complex, very multi-layered, very immersive. Then you've got Paul Noble, who makes extraordinary, predominantly extraordinary drawings of this fantasy town, Nobson Newtown, that he's been devising in his head and on paper since the mid 90s, and this town is this kind of dysfunctional, extraordinary, labyrinthine town that he's been making these great big pencil drawings, often can cover entire walls, of all the kind of different parts of this town, different services, but it's always always completely unpopulated, but it's almost like nerdy, adolescent, obsessive pencil drawings. Then you have Elizabeth Price, who makes works in film and video, and her films are very highly produced, almost quite sort of cyber in appearance. I mean, they're actually very, very exquisitely made. There was one extraordinary film that she made called User Group Disco, which were all these machines filmed in a very kind of high-res black and white, spinning around as if they were going to be put into this fictitious museum, but actually they were very banal machines, like kind of executive toys and tea makers, but filmed with a soundtrack and this kind of thundering slogans from various key writers. So she's kind of parodying museum presentation. So a rich lot, a rich lineup, I'd say.
Penelope Curtis, who's director of Britain and chair of the judges, said that the overarching feeling of these nominations is of slowness. What do you think she meant by that?
I think what she meant was it's not throat-grabbingly immediate. You have to immerse yourself in this work. I mean, it's very striking. You see one of Spartacus Chetwynd's performances, you certainly don't miss it, or indeed any of their work. But you know, it pays. It needs time. It needs to be kind of immersed within. You know, Luke's films might run for, you know, over half an hour, sometimes up to an hour. Paul Noble's drawings are labyrinthine, intricate, and the more you look at them, the more you see. Elizabeth Price's films also are very immersive. So Spartacus Chetwynd, you have to, you know, experience the performances, move through the installations. So these aren't quick hit works. They're works that do benefit from time being spent, as do all great artworks, of course, but these ones do need, they've taken a long time to make, and they take quite a long time to experience.
You mentioned the spectacular nature of Spartacus Chetwynd's performance art. Some of the critics are saying that this, her inclusion in the shortlist, is now a sign that performance art is becoming accepted as mainstream. Is that right?
Well, there certainly is a lot of performance art around, a lot of artists working with live performance and the event. And one only has to think of Tino Segal, who's doing the Turbine Hall commission at the Tate Modern this July. His work is completely about encounter and about experiencing protagonists and people within the space. It's completely time-based. He doesn't even like any of it to be recorded. A lot of other artists work in a similar way. I think in a way it's almost a kind of response to the commodification of art, that a lot of artists want to get back to a real physical encounter. Though, of course, Spartacus Chetwynd's actually shortlisted for her show in a commercial gallery, so she's got the best of both worlds.
I mentioned at the beginning of this interview that the Turner Prize is often seen as the barometer for Britain's artistic climate. In the past, it's been in the doldrums, and others it's been in, you know, in pure torment and storm. What is it like at the moment in 2012?
About the Turner Prize is, you know, it's been going for a hell of a long time, and I think it's become, I mean, people don't get so hysterical about it as they used to. It used to be that the media were all waiting to pounce and looking for a scandal and looking to be outraged about contemporary art. Contemporary art has entered the cultural mainstream. One has to look at what happens with Frieze Week in London, you know, every October. So I think, you know, it's become one amongst many prizes. It still is the big one as far as the UK is concerned, and it still has international status. I think only the Hugo Boss Prize is kind of comparable, but even the Turner Prize is more than that. So if an artist does win or is shortlisted for the Turner Prize, it's a really important addition to their CV. And I think, on the other hand, you have to remember that it is four judges and Penelope Curtis, the Tate Britain director, is the chair, and it's their subjective view of who they've singled out for notice on the strength of their show of the last year. So it's a highly subjective view. It's by no means definitive. But I think it does give an interesting snapshot, and it does show that artists at the moment, I think, are working in very complex, very multi-layered ways, and ways that have a lot of humour as well, which I think all these artists in their different ways are parodying and sending up certain aspects. Which doesn't mean to say they're not serious, but there is a kind of humour and a humanity in this work that I think is interesting.
You mentioned there that the press used to seize on every winner and loser. Does the fact that the Turner Prize is so naturalised into the mainstream media, does that affect the process or the prize itself in any way?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, it's always been a panel of art professionals. Even I did it back in the mists of time, I think 2005, I'm so bad at dates, but that was when I did it. And I think, you know, it was slightly more controversial than Simon Starling won, who made a boat into a shed and then back into a boat again. And I certainly know that when we did face the media, there was a sort of, you know, almost like a kind of hunger to try and find the scandal. And in fact, mine was shock horror. There was a painter who painted still lives in ours, albeit for quite radical reasons. So, you know, there's always a sort of desire to get an angle on the Turner Prize. But I think overall, you know, it gets very high attendance figures. People come to the Turner Prize because they're interested in contemporary art. And, that, you know, we're all more sophisticated now. We don't get so upset about art that doesn't conform to perhaps the most sort of age-old stereotypes of fine art on a plinth, on a pedestal, in a frame. Art is more radical, as we know, and we accept that. Therefore, the Turner Prize has become more integrated into the kind of into our cultural landscape.
And finally, it would be churlish of me not to ask you this question. What's your predictions?
Well, of course, as I said, it's a highly subjective enterprise. I think all four are excellent artists, but I am particularly fond of Paul Noble myself, so I'm rooting for him.
Described as a slogger at the coalface of culture, as Paul Noble. He's been going at it for ages, hasn't he?
Well, he's only 48. You know, he's not that old.
It's time left for him still. Louisa Buck, contemporary art correspondent at the Art Newspaper, many thanks indeed for joining us here on Midori House. Stay with us, because in the next half hour on Midori House, we talk tourism in Burma, the rising popularity of a religious form of finance, and we'll chat about a Spanish love bus with our man in Madrid. Can't wait. First of all, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Emma. Labour rallies marking May Day have been taking place across the world. In Taiwan, hundreds of protesters held up banners and marched through Taipei to demand better worker rights and an end to job insecurity, low salaries and long working hours. The French President Nicolas Sarkozy held a giant and elaborately produced May Day rally in front of the Eiffel Tower with barely 5 days to go before the final round of voting in presidential elections, as opinion polls put him behind the socialist candidate François Hollande. The French far-right leader Marine Le Pen delivered a further blow to President Sarkozy's re-election hopes by refusing to endorse him and telling her 6 million supporters to make their own choice in Sunday's ballot. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is beginning a high-stakes trip to Beijing, where a blind Chinese human rights lawyer is reportedly holed up in the US embassy in a drama threatening to overshadow top-level meetings between the two governments. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has met opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi in the latest stage of a three-day visit to Burma to encourage more democratic reforms. A British parliamentary committee has declared News Corp chief executive Rupert Murdoch unfit to run a major international company, saying he should take responsibility for a culture of illegal phone hacking that has shaken the media empire. And the flag was flying at half-mast outside the Norwegian Olympic Committee building today in honour of world champion swimmer Alexander Dale Owen, who has died of a suspected heart attack in Arizona at the age of 26. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
And a warm welcome back to Midori House. Political life in Burma is progressing at a keen pace. First, the Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has said her opposition party will take its place in the country's parliament. This is despite no change to the oath of loyalty to the constitution. And secondly, the UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has urged foreign countries now to lift their sanctions and embrace and invest in Burma. Well, one man keen to embrace and invest in Burma and part with his piggy bank is Bruce Leishman, our man usually in Ukraine, but just back from a trip to Burma, I believe. Bruce, a warm welcome back. Before we move on to you and your personal visits to Burma, I mentioned there Aung San Suu Kyi taking her place in Parliament. This is a very significant move, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And today, you know, I was there. I just arrived in Bangkok literally an hour and a half ago. And, you know, this afternoon we were just outside Aung San Suu Kyi's house. And, you know, my driver was saying, you know, never before would they ever imagine that they would be driving past his house or indeed standing outside of it, you know, because there was a certain degree of fear that that surrounded the entire area. So there certainly is a new feeling in Burma, and people are very excited about it, and people are talking about it. But there is, you know, the changes, it has to be said, remain are small steps.
Secondly, the UN Secretary General has given his blessing for foreign countries to lift their sanctions. What kind of reaction has that had? And how much of a change can you feel when you're in Burma in terms of people getting ready for the new money to come in?
Yeah, well, I think there's a few aspects of that. First of all, the flights getting in there at the moment are full, and it's full of bureaucrats and also a lot of business people are going in. So you do see people gearing up to really open up the economy. And you see that in the hotels and on the flights. And speaking to the tourism operators, I suppose, is where you see, you know, the real hope there, and all the tourism operators are hoping after years of having very small numbers of tourists really enter the country, that it's shaping up to be an incredibly busy period for the Burmese tourism industry.
Now, Bruce, you've just been on a Burmese 3 to 4 day mini break, haven't you? How did you find the country?
Look, you know what? I have to say, I hadn't been before. I've been, you know, all of extensively throughout the region, and I have to say, it's charming, absolutely delightful. Yangon or Rangoon is a charming city. It's kind of it's amazing colonial architecture, a little bit crumbling, a little bit chaotic, but also has a nice degree of order about it, and very pleasant service, somewhat surprisingly, and a very nice kind of reserved people, and a very interesting cultural mix. And that's a great thing about Burma. It really is this crossroads of India and China. But then, you know, and other minorities as well. There are still, you know, a number of people that trace their origins to Iraq, and of course, you know, a number of people that have European heritage as well.
So what's the tourism infrastructure like there?
Look, pretty poor and a little bit difficult, and that's the thing. At the moment, to get in there, and I booked everything last week, and I have to say, incredibly difficult to get hotels, to get flights around the country. Everything's booked out. And of course, you know, everything has to be paid for in cash because credit cards are not are not still not used in are not permitted to be used in Burma, even in the even in the major hotels. So it is it's a difficult thing to book. It kind of reminded me the last time I was in Damascus was about 24 months ago, and Damascus at that point was kind of riding on a wave of as a very hot tourism destination, and it was impossible to get accommodation in Damascus, and this kind of reminded me of that. So it is difficult, and this is the question though of that is that that people are talking about there. In which direction does the country want to go in terms of tourism? Does it want to become a mass tourism destination and bring in everybody? Or, as some people are saying, does the country want to become, shall we say, a little more of a high-end tourist destination aimed at a slightly, higher-spend clientele and to develop its tourism infrastructure a little bit differently? So there is a lot of discussion going on about that, but you see a lot of people are just lining up to really, to take on mass tourism.
Bruce, what's the media openness like at the moment? I understand that you have a copy of the local paper there to tell us what's on the front pages.
This was a slightly surreal moment. I was in, I was in the foyer today of the Strand Hotel in Yangon, which is a beautiful colonial era building on the port. And it's kind of fans wave, fans in the ceiling and staff bringing you cold towels. And I'm reading The New Light of Myanmar, which is the government's English language mouthpiece. And, of course, it's actually celebrating May Day today, so it's all about true patriotism and the plight of the worker. But in addition to that, it is all about at the moment, the UN trip and Ban Ki-moon's visit. It's a huge headline here. The UN will normalize its operations in Myanmar at full capacity and as quickly as possible. And over the page is also huge coverage of the German delegation, and they had their Airbus 330 at the airport when I arrived a few days ago. But down the bottom of the second story on the front page, the headline to that is, all forms of forced labour should be eliminated once and for all. So it kind of just does demonstrate, I think, as I was sitting there having a nice, iced lemon tea with a cold towel on my head, that change is slow and there still is a lot of work to be done.
Bruce, enjoy your towel and your iced lemon tea. That was Monocle's man in Kiev, Bruce Leishman, talking from Bangkok on his recent trip to Burma. A well-travelled man indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for some music. This is Never Never by Subtract.
I'll never let you down. Singing, oh, I never left the crowd.
And that was Subtract on Monocle 24 and Never Never. Stay with us here on Midori House because we'll be right back with an assessment of the Islamic financing world.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7, and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
14 minutes to the top of the hour here on Monocle 24, and you're listening to Midori House. Well, in the midst of a global economic crisis, it's a form of investment that's booming. It's low risk and it's been expanding at almost 25% each year since the 1990s. Sharia law financing now totals $1.2 trillion, or approximately 1% of the global financial system. Well, to tell us more, joining us now on the line from Toronto, I'm terribly sorry, but based in Dubai, is Atif Khan, the Managing Director at the Etika Institute of Islamic Finance. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Atif. Why is the Islamic financing enjoying such an enduring popularity?
Thank you, Emma. I think there's a variety of reasons that are coinciding in the last few years. One of them may be perhaps a growing movement across all industries calling for sustainability. So whether it's sustainable energy, food, or economics, there's perhaps a collective realization that the planet is finite and we have to apply the same principles to sustainable banking. So people's needs need to get served through financings and institutions as well. But we cannot go on with the exponential growth and the, every decade or so collapses that interest-based finance we've seen over the last century, really.
Well, when we talk,
this is perhaps one of the reasons.
When we talk about Islamic financial practices, aren't we basing them on? Although we're basing it on Sharia law. The whole system is based on universal principles of equity, trading, leasing, and these are all tied to assets and services, aren't they?
Yes, very much so. You hit the nail on the head. Banking, if it can loosely be described as equity, debt, trading, and lease-based, Islamic banking just takes debt out of that equation and creates products that are based on equity, trading, and leasing alone.
Is it, however, some critics say that this is a niche system, so that you run into trouble when you get non-Sharia compliant instruments, or when you want to switch between Sharia based and non-Sharia based tools, it becomes a bit of a problem.
Well, it's niche right now simply because it's relatively small, 1.2 trillion. However impressive that sounds, is still 1% of the conventional market, and it's growing. But the issue isn't the Sharia or Islamic finance per se. The issue is really how do we provide financing that is free of interest, which is an Abrahamic injunction since time immemorial. Christianity and Judaism have banned interest, and it's only in the recent centuries that it's come back. So we know that there's problems with interest, not just in Islam, but in other traditions. So there's a realization that we can do many of the things that we currently do are already Islamic. So, for instance, an equity-based transaction needn't be called Islamic finance necessarily. It could just as well be interest-free and therefore Islamic. So it's being practiced in many ways already, but the label Islamic finance is a relatively new one.
When you talk about Islamic finance, is there still a stigma attached to the name Islamic, or should it just be more, called more equitable financing?
Only for whom the word Islamic attaches itself a stigma. For people who are in Eastern markets, and Ethica, for instance, has students in 44 countries, we're seeing rampant growth in places that are not Muslim. For instance, India, which has many Muslims, but the government is now talking about introducing Islamic finance. And Canada, parts of Africa, even South America, China, Japan, we've seen interest in Islamic finance coming from all quarters.
You talk about the emerging markets, but there's also an emerging academic world behind all this, because I understand that places like the Cass Business School in London also have a Dubai-based office. Is there, how big is this new education system behind?
I think it's growing very rapidly. Cass has been around for a few years now. For instance, Ethica has been making a push in the West, where, for instance, in North America, there's over 3,000 universities. So we're getting a lot of demand from places where traditionally there haven't been high volumes in Islamic finance transactions. So there is a growing interest among students and academics in providing Islamic finance education.
I mentioned at the beginning of this interview that there's 25% growth per year since the 1990s. I mean, that is quite an astonishing figure. When do you think this is all going to reach saturation point?
Well, you have to remember, 25%, we always get excited about that number. It's starting from a low base, so naturally it's going to be a higher percentage. And as it plateaus, it's going to reduce. But there doesn't seem to be much decreasing. And also, you have to remember, the markets have slowed down dramatically. So that number has been used a lot, and I don't know how much meaning it has in terms of people being able to get jobs in Islamic finance. So it may be growing in terms of its spread across many different countries, but in terms of within countries, people are having difficulty finding jobs in Islamic finance in places like the Gulf, for instance, like Dubai. So it's growing in some places in that sense. For instance, we have students now in Nigeria because there's a growing interest coming from the regulators to introduce Islamic finance in that part of the world. So in that sense, yes, there's growth, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily growth everywhere across the board.
And would you say, can you say in the long term, Islamic finance not just necessarily growing within itself, but other larger Western banks adopting a more equitable approach in response to the popularity of Islamic finance?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of institutions have seen the successes of HSBC, which has an Islamic finance division, Standard Chartered and others, and they've been able to grow their franchises alongside their conventional franchises. But I think there is now, thankfully, a growing realization that Islamic finance as an industry itself has to create better standards, because it's Sharia compliant, if I say it's Sharia compliant, which is the current standard, rather than something that's, for instance, AOFI based. AOFI stands for the Accounting and Auditing Organization for Islamic Financial Institutions, which is an accepted standard among scholars and jurisdictions, but it hasn't been implemented effectively enough.
Atif Khan, Managing Director at the Ethica Institute in Dubai, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. 7 minutes to the top of the hour. Six minutes to the top of the hour, you're listening to Midori House. Well, with the economic crisis biting in Spain, the steady depopulation of some of the country's smallest villages has also become an even bigger problem. Gosh, if you haven't got money and you can't have love, what have you got? So enter Las Caravanas de Mujeres, or Women Caravans, a small business organising day trips to these little towns in the hope of playing Cupid and reversing the downward population growth. Our Liam Aldous paid a visit to the organisation's director, Manuel Gonzalo, to discuss whether the rural dating venture, or the affectionately dubbed Love Bus, is working.
You've been doing these tours since 1985. What inspired you to open the business? And I heard you saw a movie.
Yes, I saw a film called The Women in Caravans, which was based on an American television series.
And is depopulation in Spain's towns becoming a problem, do you think?
It is a problem. The major problem is the proportion of men far outweighs the proportion of women.
Okay, tell me and describe to me the typical profile of the women that sign up to these trips.
They're between the ages of 25 and 60. Only about 15% are from Spain. The rest come from Latin America.
Okay, what kinds of activities do you arrange for the women when they get to the town?
First they have lunch, and then a dancing contest, which is always a bit of a laughing matter, and then dinner, and then a huge dance in the town where everyone joins in.
Okay, tell me about some of the success stories. Have you been invited to any weddings, for example?
I've never actually been invited to a wedding, but there has been 30 weddings. I was invited to a dinner at one stage as a thank you.
I couldn't help but notice that some of the questions on the questionnaire are quite specific. Why is it important to know whether a woman leaves the plug in the drain after showering, for example?
Basically, this is a question to indicate whether the applicant is responsible and clean at home and whether they're a good candidate for a wife. You can see from our lounge room, cleanliness is very important to me.
Do you think that these caravanas have made a difference in Spain?
I haven't made a huge difference, but I've made a small difference. Between 120 and 150 women have moved to small towns because of the tours. Every little thing makes a difference. There's been marriages that have had children, and this has obviously contributed to the growth of the town.
And that was Manuel Gonzalo talking to Liam. Liam, you're on the phone. Liam Aldous, reporting from Spain and on the line to us now. Liam, I've just been dumbstruck by the sound of Manuel Gonzalo. I bet the ladies are queuing up on his love bus.
No, they are, and he's got the top of the lot, I guess, because he's leading the bus, so he gets to choose them all.
So explain to us where we can find these poor lovelorn boys in these remote mountain, in these remote villages. Is this big cities? Is this little villages? Where is it?
Well, there are small villages all around Spain, and I mean, I did ask him as well, has it kind of created a phenomenon of these men becoming quite picky with women? Because if they've got busloads of women coming every week, they get to, if they don't like the women one week, they know that there's another busload coming the next week. So I asked him if this becomes a problem, but he basically said no, they're very grateful, they enjoy the breath of fresh air in the town, and they go around all of Spain, so it's not like they're just going to one village every week.
Oh, right, so the girls actually do a sort of a village crawl. Then?
No, they're different girls. It's not the same. Can you imagine the same bunch of girls going around all of Spain? That would be a different kind of tour.
In certain parts of the regions of the United Kingdom on a Friday night, yes, indeed, I could, actually. These ladies, are they sort of repeat customers, or do they sort of give up after a while? What's their tactic?
Well, I mean, if you look at the figures, quite a high percentage, like 85% are foreign women. So there is a bit of an ulterior motive here, maybe, to get papers. But I guess if the men are lonely in their village, I guess everyone wins. So, I mean, he did say there have been a few marriages and 150 people have moved to the town, as far as he knows. So, I mean, at the end of the day, while some of the Spanish people I talk to about this are quite cynical and they see it as a form of perhaps kind of institutionalized prostitution, I think it's still kind of a good thing to kind of reverse the trend of depopulation. So, I mean, without being cynical, I think it's quite a sweet little story.
Liam, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's all for this Tuesday's edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Toby Habband. At 2200 hours, that's in 3 hours' time, you can join us on the Monocle Daily. From all of us on the Midori House Love Bus, goodbye.